Eric Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Brian Ertz. He's board president of Wildlands Defense. He spent the last decade resisting this culture's depraved relationship to the natural world via grassroots organizing, national media initiatives, administrative and legislative policy advocacy, and support of a variety of litigation efforts aimed at preserving a wide variety of landscapes and wildlife species in the West. So, as always, thank you for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's talk about what's going on in Oregon. Can you give people first a brief background of, I mean, just tell them physically what's happening, and then after that, I'll ask you a question about the background.
Sure. So physically what's happening is there's a group of right-wing militia members led by Ammon Bundy and his brother Ryan Bundy, who are sons of Cliven Bundy, have taken over the Malheur National Refuge headquarters and are demanding certain concessions from the federal government before they leave. So there's a long history to why. Basically what you see is over the course of time, greater tensions. For example, a few years ago, Cliven Bundy refusing to pay his grazing fees to graze cattle on federal public land that had protections for the desert tortoise, stood off with similarly situated militia members, and the federal government backed down. And so for the past couple of years, there have been, Cliven obviously was not prosecuted, and so the agitation and the sense of entitlement that these ranchers have has grown, fomenting the current circumstance in Malheur. So that's what's happening in Oregon.
About how many people are up there, do you know?
I don't know. Various media accounts have suggested maybe 24. There seem to be different militias going in and out. Brandon Curtis, who is the self-proclaimed leader of the Idaho 3%ers, moved in a couple days ago and claimed to be keeping the peace. And then I guess he was asked to leave, and it's all, chaos going on there now. I've heard that there's actually more media than there are occupiers in the headquarters.
So, and let's be clear, they are armed, which means they have guns.
Absolutely. They're armed and they're brandishing those arms, and they've threatened violence. They claim that they won't be the initiators of violence, but that they will respond with decisive violence if the federal government moves in to enforce the law. They don't recognize the law as is or the authority of the federal government to do anything because they adhere to a quote-unquote constitutionalist principle that really the counties and the sheriff exercise jurisdiction on what everyone else understands to be federal lands. And ironically, the sheriff there in the county there wants them to leave as well. So currently negotiations to get them out are underway. The sheriff has offered to escort them out of the state and not prosecute, given his jurisdiction. But the Bundys have so far rejected those offers and maintained their stand in the headquarters.
So what is their... the way this has been presented, in sort of a right-wing perspective or an anti-environmentalist perspective, especially, is that the Bundys have claimed they are responding to a land grab. Can you first give their perspective, as long as it doesn't make you want to take a shower right afterwards, and then respond to that perspective? I mean, basically give their best argument and then respond to it.
Sure. So their best argument is a reading of the U.S. Constitution, which they claim does not permit the federal government to own land beyond Washington, D.C. And they cite, you know, a section of the Constitution without citing many others, nor the court cases, that really seeks to establish local control of the land. And so they say that when the states gave over the land to the federal government, the public lands, of which many states, more land is actual federal public land than private or state land, they say that the states didn't have jurisdiction to turn over the land to the federal government, and that their quote-unquote rights to use the land supersede the federal government's right to restrict them from using the land. And so they're aggrieved by particularly environmental regulations that seek to protect environmental values. And they're making their stand in confrontation and to try to establish land that's controlled by the locals. So the land uses, which are controlled by the locals, are trying to reestablish local control of the land.
Well, if...
And... Go ahead.
I was going to say, if the federal government... I mean, it's just nonsense that the federal government... To say the federal government can't own land, because the federal government... The railroad land grants were based upon the federal government granting that land to the railroads. And the Homestead Act was based on the federal government granting land to individual homesteaders and to, you know, various economic entities. And we can certainly talk about the way the federal government got that land by stealing it from the original inhabitants, from the American Indians. But once the federal government stole the land, how could the federal government grant it to a railroad company if the federal government didn't own it? That doesn't make any sense. Do you see what I'm getting at? It's the argument. That
absolutely.
It's completely ahistorical.
The history, absolutely. And the point you're making is absolutely true. And the irony is, you know, Aaron Beatty of the Pacific Standard published on the 7th, so 3 days ago, a great history of the local land ownership right there in the county and in Harney County. And the irony is that, you know, a lot of the land was outright given via the Homestead Act and other acts to private industry to exploit as they would. And of course, you know, the indigenous people, the Native Americans, had first right, and it was a crime that they were deprived that in the get-go. But even with the federal government's ownership, particularly in Harney County and throughout the West, the federal government's title to the land is absolute. And in fact, in many instances, when the federal government did grant the land to private property use, such as grazing, timber, mining, it was actually an act of bailing out those industries to purchase it back. Because as those industries were going belly up, the federal government went in and bought the land back from the private industries to enrich the cattle barons and the mining barons and everyone throughout history. So it's actually an interesting history. And now what you have is a situation where they're claiming, you know, private right to use the land. But the reality is that even if they owned the land, they'd pay more taxes than fees assessed. So really what they want is control. They want the federal government to pay for all of the industrial uses, to enable those industrial uses. They just don't want to be regulated by that same federal government.
So let's talk, for people, especially in the East, about... the welfare ranchers, miners, loggers. Talk about the relationship between the federal land management and the free market in terms of what sort of sweetheart deals those who exploit, those who steal from our public lands, or to use their language, those who ranch on them, or graze on them, or mine them, or cut trees on them. Talk about the relationship between that and the sweetheart deals they get, the subsidies. These are the people.
Sure, so.
These are the people that we're talking about. Like Cliven Bundy did not pay, has not paid for the last 20 years to graze on public lands, and not only did he not pay, but in addition, what would he have paid had he actually been going to pay the money he didn't?
Sure. So it's actually quite fascinating because, you know, first we should talk about the impact that these industries have in semi-arid and arid landscapes, which is extreme. Public lands ranching is responsible for more species imperilment, more listed species under the Endangered Species Act, or candidate species than any other human use. It's responsible for more water defilement than any other human use, and it's responsible for habitat degradation or desertification more than any other human use in America. And so, and it's all done at a subsidized rate. So in the private sphere, if you were to rent or lease private land to graze cattle, you would pay on average $20 per AUM, which is an animal unit month, which is the amount of feed that a cow and her calf eat in a month. So you pay $20. If you're permitting from the federal government under the BLM, Cliven Bundy owed $1.35 per month that he just refused to pay for 20 years. So it's radically less than what the private ranchers pay.
So this would be
now
the equivalent of, this would be the equivalent of, let's just say you pay, you know, $600 a month for an apartment or $800 a month for an apartment. This would be the equivalent of getting that $800 a month apartment for $10 a month? Wait, it's 10%. No, so it's $100 a month.
Yeah, about $60 a month.
Okay.
And not only do they pay a radically subsidized rate in that respect, but they also receive any number of direct federal subsidies, so hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars, depending on the ranching operation, the rancher, just for the meat that they produce or the grain that they produce. In addition, they get services from things like Wildlife Services, which is a whole federal government agency under the auspice of the U.S. Department of Agriculture that exterminates predators on behalf out in the wild lands to accommodate the private ranchers' cattle. Roads, so the federal government pays for roads. The federal government pays for fencing. The federal government pays for the water developments. The federal government pays for weed abatement. The federal government pays for rehabilitation when the cattle destroy the land. And all of these things, generally the federal grazing program costs the U.S. taxpayer over $120 million per year in direct deficit costs. And then when the indirect costs associated with the, you know, weed and predator abatement, the livestock installations, the rehabilitation programs, and the costs associated with the government agents to regulate the activity, you're looking at, you know, between $500 million and $1 billion a year in costs that the U.S. taxpayer pays to subsidize this industry.
And these are the people who are saying that they want the government off their backs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they believe themselves entitled, and they've always believed themselves entitled. And so what they're doing right now is chafing against the terms and conditions of their use of those public lands. And those terms and conditions are the protection of habitat and of the wildlife. So when, you know, the greater sage grouse is going extinct, largely because of livestock grazing, the federal government requires or should require, you know, curtailed impact to accommodate the continued survival of the species. And the same is true with wolves, and the same is true with any number of fish species. And they don't like that. They don't like those conditions.
So this is also part. This is one tactic or one tactic. This occupation is one tactic in a larger long-term campaign. Can you talk at all about the history of this campaign? And I'm thinking go back to the 80s if you can, and then bring it forward through the various just put this in the context of the larger social movement on the part, the larger anti-environmental movement on the part of the ranchers, off-road vehicle people, mining. Because before we go there, one of the Bundy's explicit demands for the end of this current occupation is increased, not just ranching, but increased mining and logging. So this is all part. Oh wait, actually, sorry. Before we go there, I want to debunk one more thing about the whole public lands rancher cowboy thing, and that's a lot of people don't know that the typical public lands rancher is not named Fred or Joe, but the typical public lands rancher is named Limited Liability Corporation, as in Budweiser, the Mormon Church. That actually there are huge economic entities. I'm not saying that the Bundys are specifically associated with them, but the typical public lands rancher is a corporation. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. I mean, we can talk. Yeah, Anheuser-Busch is the largest public lands rancher in California. Mary Hewlett Jaffe of the Hewlett-Packard, you know, the printers. The Hewlett-Packard Empire is the largest in central Idaho. You've got Barrick Gold, which is actually a mining corporation, International Gold Mining Corporation. They're one of the largest in Nevada. These are corporate enterprises, and the reason that they ranch is not so much because of the profitability of the ranching per se. It has more to do with control over other benefits associated with the activity, namely political benefits, water rights, and other benefits that ranchers receive. And so this is a corporate enterprise, mostly, that's happening on public land. And the idea of the, you know, the cowboy, the independent cowboy riding into the sunset, that just doesn't exist. And it really hasn't ever existed as, you know, the general population has understood it to exist. These are giant corporations that are utilizing control of lands that belong to all of us under the auspice of a cowboy myth. So,
can you do a quick bow to the mining law in terms of how much they pay for mining, like American Barrick or any of these others?
Oh, absolutely. Well, right now under the existing, what is it, 1876 mining law? Is it six or two?
That's the reason I didn't say, is because I can't remember if it's two or six.
Yeah, it's two or six. Anyway, it's a law that exists, and it hasn't been able to get removed over the years. It's persisted. But essentially, you know, anybody has the right to go in right now under this law and use the land to mine, and they can patent that land. So users that mine go in to like a Forest Service or a BLM landscape, find minerals, make use of the minerals, and then patent the land. It becomes private property. And depending on what mineral you're harvesting from the landscape, they do have to pay for that, but obviously it's less than private. There, there's a, you know, Timothy DeChristopher had that controversy where he went in and auctioned it, optioned with no intention of actually paying for the mineral rights that he was off, that he was bidding on. But yeah, it's also a subsidized industry because you can go in and get free land and free use of the land on public lands if you demonstrate an intent to actually mine.
And once again, there are a few, you know, cranky prospectors with big beards who are destructive enough. But once again, when we're generally talking about, we're talking about transnational corporations.
Absolutely, the transnational corporations. And the individuals which are, you know, highlighted for political reasons by the right wing, typically they don't go into a boardroom with their cameras and they don't, you know, yell on behalf of their corporate constituents when they're making speeches in hearings in Congress. And they rely upon this mythology of these, you know, salt of the earth characters that really are insignificant, marginal interests when it comes to the grand scheme of things. And often with mining in particular, a lot what we've been seeing is recreational mining. So you'll see permits to use and patent the lands for recreational mining, wherein people just get a kick out of, you know, the old idea that there are people out there panning for gold, but then they bring in these suction dredging apparatus that does extreme damage to spawning habitat for fish and to the rivers for recreational purposes. So
what this, on one level, what this occupation is about opening up more federal lands to all of those depredations. Can you now that I've interrupted you so many times, can you put this in the context of this move, this anti-environmental / wise use / blue ribbon / whatever you want to call it, movement for the past at least 30 years?
Sure. So in the 70s, what we saw is the codification of a lot of environmental protections, a lot of really wonderful environmental protections. So you saw the Endangered Species Act, you saw the Clean Water Act, you saw the various agencies' organic acts. So in the case of Interior, it's the FLPMA, Federal Land Policy Management Act. And in the case of the Forest Service, it's NFMA, which is the National Forest Management Act. And what these laws did was they said, whoa, 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 we're exploiting the landscape to such a degree that it's being destroyed everywhere. And so what we're going to do is we're going to set certain baseline standards for, quote unquote, sustainable use of the public lands. And shortly thereafter, in the late 70s, early 80s, what you saw is what a lot of people refer to as the Sagebrush Rebellion, which was rural people responding to those environmental protections, whereas before they had free use to just rapaciously exploit the federal lands. Now there were rules that limited it such that a public environmental interest could be protected. And in responding to that, you saw a lot of episodes similar to what's happening now with Clive and Bundy and with his sons in Oregon. And actually, we see a lot of these things happening all over the West that don't get the same media attention. For example, in Nevada, in central Idaho, there was a mining standoff. There are shovel brigades to keep road access open, or to bulldoze road access into wilderness areas. And so the Sagebrush Rebellion and the Wise Use Movement really took place under the Reagan administration. And the beginnings of those movements, those localized movements, began to get political wind at the back of their sails. And so you saw the Wise Use Movement, which is a band of Western legislators and policymakers who sought to localized control of the federal commons. And this happened in the 40s as well. Bernard DeVoto, these same things. Bernard DeVoto was the one that really blew the whistle on that in the 40s. But further iterations happen, and the Sagebrush Rebellion in the 70s and 80s is really where you saw the beginnings of this existing, this existing effort. And it became a legitimate political agenda. So these aren't just crazy people out there waving their guns. They have legislators at their back, and they're advancing a political agenda to undermine and, destroy the environmental protections that came out of the 70s.
And so can you give a sort of constellation of some of their other political actions, such as, do you think it's fair to talk about the predator derbies in the same breath as the wise use? I mean, are those related, do you think? And if so, I mean, like, mention those or other actions that the wise use movement in general is doing.
Absolutely. So, you know, I would argue that the predator derbies that are occurring in Western states are related. Generally, it's a general localized chafing against federal control. And so when you saw the reintroduction of wolves in the West, in central Idaho, Yellowstone, they created this narrative that it was the oppressive, tyrannical federal government imposing these wolves upon them, which would eat their livestock, et cetera. And so the derbies, I would argue, are really a political statement. They're expressions of their intent with respect to the federal enemy that they perceive. There are other more directly rancher-related activities that are happening.
Tell people who might not live in the West what a predator derby is.
So a predator derby is a public event where a bunch of rural cowboy, salt of the earth type individuals get together, and they have a contest, a public contest, and they ask people to contribute, to register for these contests, they have different age categories, and then they give cash prizes to those who kill the most, whether it be coyotes or wolves or other species. It's a competition. It's a public competition that rewards those who kill the most wildlife and bring their bodies in. They measure their bodies. They yip, they holler, they celebrate the destruction of environmental values, including predators, as almost a spite to the federal government with respect to protections that various predators may or may not have. And so that's what they do.
And what are some of the other activities that you would put under the same sort of umbrella?
Well, there are a number. Some that are happening right now, for example, are in Nevada. Which there's the Battle Mountain BLM field office, which shortly after the Cliven Bundy episode in Nevada, you saw ranchers really galvanized, public lands ranchers really galvanized that here's this public land rancher that got away with a militant standoff with the federal government. And so in order to accommodate or in order to protect the landscape from the drought that existed last year or in 2014, BLM field managers decided we need to cut back the use of grazing. We can't graze as many cattle. And so they closed allotments on the Argenta field office, or on the Argenta allotment. And in response, the cowboys got together and they created what they call the Grass March, which was basically a protest campaign of terror against the federal manager, Doug Furtado, who was responsible for making the decision to initiate those drought closures. And so they threatened, and they threatened him, and they raised a bunch of hell with the with their politicians, and basically got what they want. BLM folded, reopened the allotments, despite the lawless behavior of the ranchers, and they continue to graze on the Argenta allotment under the auspice of a settlement. And this is happening, you know, the same thing is happening on the North Buffalo allotment, the Long and Humboldt allotment. Basically, ranchers, in an effort, federal managers under the BLM, in an effort to prevent the next standoff, are folding and allowing just lawless behavior to occur without enforcing the environmental protections that exist, because they want to avoid the political standoff that would occur with these ranchers. And so that's what's happening in a lot of areas of the country, is we see a lack of enforcement of the environmental protections and an effort of the agencies to avoid confrontations like we see in Oregon, or like we saw with Clive and Bundy.
And what do you think is the relationship, or is there a relationship between the fact that these people are armed and the fact that the BLM folds? Do you believe that there's a relationship between that, or do you believe that that's not relevant?
No, I think there's absolutely a relationship. There are two problems at the BLM and with land managers. One is that there's a contingent of land managers that are captured by the industries they're supposed to regulate. So they're the friends and family of the ranchers or the miners or the loggers. And so they're sympathetic, and so they are permissive with respect to rapacious land uses that violate federal law. There's another, which is those individuals within the agency that are actually have a conservation ethic, and that, you know, come from the university, idealistic about how they're going to manage, you know, whatever plot of land, federal land, is in their jurisdiction in such a way as to, you know, allow wildlife and the natural habitat to flourish, and they take it seriously. And the response of the response of the ranchers to that is to typically intimidate them, and to all the way up through various means throughout, you know, whether it be having politicians with letterhead send letters to the agency, all the way up to brandishing firearms. It's an extremely effective way of subduing the enforcement of environmental protections on a local scale. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, but, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily want to risk their lives, you know, over an issue that of whether or not, you know, to reduce the number of cattle from 2,000 to 1,500. And so they're apt to stand down. And they certainly don't want the political theater that's occurring to take place under their watch. And so brandishing weapons, direct intimidation and threat really does have a meaningful impact at the agency. And it's scary. It's unfortunate. And it's the land and wildlife that ends up, you know, as everyone else is talking about, we want to avoid, you know, violence. We want to avoid anyone getting hurt amongst people. Not a lot of people really talk about the consequences to the landscape and the wildlife as BLM bows down and abstains from enforcing in an effort to appease the people that are threatening violence.
One of the reasons that I decided to interview you about this as opposed to some other people is, I mean, apart from the fact that you do just great work generally, is that you had written that one of the purposes, you believe, of this current standoff is to assist the ranchers slash miners slash loggers in their next round of negotiations with the BLM. And I think you've sort of hinted at that, but can you talk about that a bit more explicitly?
Absolutely. So what you see, well, when the Hammonds, who are the ranchers, you know, adjacent to the Malheur, when they got arrested, their permit also got revoked because they torched, you know, over 100 acres of public land, and that's why they got arrested. And so their permit to graze on that landscape got revoked by the Bureau of Land Management. And the same is happening as the habitat continues to spiral downward on public lands throughout the West. There is an effort to curtail those impacts and limit those uses to more justifiable level. And so what these guys are doing is they're out there and they're sending a message throughout the agency. And they're sending the message that I talked about just prior, which is, look, if you enforce the law, if you enforce limitations on ranching, mining, logging, then there's a chance that you'll have an armed showdown like this. And so what that does is it sends an intimidating, you know, shiver through the agency to further bolster ranchers' position with respect to keeping the numbers as they are or lawlessly grazing them. Furthermore, politically, you know, it gives the politicians the grievance to reform public lands management in such a way to increase local and state influence in the policies that are administering these public lands. And so by threatening, you know, they want to turn all federal government over to county or states or to private actors. That's the ask. They'll never get that ask politically. It's possible, but I don't really think it's probable that what they'll get is a disposal of federal public lands to state ownership. What I think they're doing now is posturing, or the politicians will posture with this theater to increase local and state actors' influence as they're administering the federal laws. And what that influence does is it rolls back further the enforcement of the environmental statutes. And so is that what you're asking as far as...
Yeah, that's exactly what I was asking. So the next question is, I don't know if you've encountered this, but I've encountered a fair number of people whose politics are generally really good, who at least at first were buying into the notion that these... Basically, they were saying, wow, somebody is opposing... And we all know that the federal government takes care of corporations, it takes care of the rich. We all know that. We all know that the federal government oversees the destruction of the natural world. But for a while, at the beginning of this, there were a fair number of people who were environmentalists who were still, or who didn't necessarily know about, who haven't lived among these people. Oh, before we go any further, can you mention the three S's as their relationship with a lot of these people to endangered species?
Sure, the three S's are, it's shoot, shovel, and shut up. Is that what you're referring to? And
yeah. Yeah, so, just to make clear once again, the relationship, how much these people hate nature. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So when, for example, the wolf was endangered or enjoyed endangered species protections in Idaho, they still do in Oregon, Washington, California, and elsewhere. But typically what, you know, a lot of even county sheriffs and local ranchers or miners or all those of that mindset, they had a running joke, which was, you know, just shoot, shovel, and shut up. if you see something that is endangered on the landscape because they're out there and nobody else really is, or there isn't a, you know, high degree of law enforcement, then, you know, the joke is to shoot, shovel, and shut up. You kill the animal, you dig a hole, and you bury it, and you walk away. And so, you know, it's a ubiquitous mentality that exists to destroy wildlife. It's the culture of death that exists out there anyway. And so that's what we're dealing with, is a direct hostility toward wildlife and wild landscapes, and the federal government's attempts to enforce regulations which protect those species.
How have so many sort of anti-authoritarian types, how did they get bamboozled by the Bundys and the others to support them, at least at first? I've been trying to shoot down that notion as much as I can, but I still see a fair number of anti-authoritarian people who think that this is a righteous thing. Have you experienced that?
Absolutely. I've got friends who are generally, I would say, have great environmental, a great environmental ethic, who just like the idea of somebody taking a stand against the federal government. And you know, and I mean, I can appreciate, you know, I'm an anti-authoritarian as well, as far as, you know, I have grievances with respect to the way that the federal government doesn't enforce environmental regulations enough. And I get frustrated by the failures of establishment modes of advocacy to respond to the legitimate grievances and shortcomings of existing law. And so I think for those people that are on the ground and that who understand and experience the, you know, urgent imperative to do something on behalf of that which they love, that comes along with that on-the-ground experience, there can be, you know, a certain sympathy for just somebody who's doing something. And so, and there's that general ethos exists in the West of, you know, anti-establishment in general. And so, you know, because we're dealing with, you know, the corporate influence, as you mentioned, and the corporate degree of control and destruction of the environmental values that a lot of us that are, you know, environmentalists work to preserve, you know, there's an appropriate exercise of authority, and there's an inappropriate exercise of authority. And I would argue that the enforcement of environmental protections, which protect, you know, God's very creation, is an appropriate exercise of authority. And in the absence of federal authority, whether it be just state, county, or localized actors, you're going to see a great deal of destruction of those, of wild lands and wild communities of life. And so I would argue, you know, I would argue that this is the inappropriate context, or is an inappropriate context with which to express that anti-authoritarian sentiment with respect to a radical response to the federal government.
And once again, what they're arguing for is the ability to exploit. I mean, this, for anything, for me, this feels, if anything, more like the, you know, the KKK intimidating people, or any other authoritarian, you know, neo-fascists intimidating people, brown shirts intimidating people, in order to promote the ultimately authoritarian and exploitative agenda.
Absolutely. And what you see is what you will see in the aftermath of this latest iteration in Oregon is you'll see political capital that's exploited by the establishment anti-environmental politicians. And they'll be pushing for greater local, you know, stakeholder standing in federal management decisions. And, you know, so it's being, this is political theater, and it's going to lend wind and energy to anti-environmental efforts of the federal government.
So we have like three or four or five minutes left. I've got a couple questions. The first question is, just to be explicit, what do you think would happen if this were identical, except that it was environmentalists, and if environmentalists took over federal building, not with paper mache masks, but took over it with weapons? Do you think that the response by the feds would be as restrained?
Well, this is where, you know, I'm conflicted about that question.
And this I am too, actually.
I mean, I think it's a legitimate question. And my first knee-jerk reaction is to say, oh, no, they'd wipe us out. But at the same time, I have to think, you know, what the federal government is doing right now, what the FBI, BLM is doing right now, is they're kind of showing their hand about how they would approach armed, you know, insurrectionists or somebody that's going to confront them in an armed fashion. And it seems like unless they take decisive action here to stamp that out, then they're galvanizing, you know, a response, whether it be environmentalists or, you know, cult followers or whoever might be radicalized enough or more, you know, more of the same with respect to anti-environmental interests. It seems like, you know, if this is their response and if this Clive and Bundy standoff is as effective and, you know, a mode of advocacy as it appears to be and as it has appeared to be with Clive and Bundy, then what they're doing is, you know, showing everybody, no matter what their interests, that if you want to get your point across, this is one way of doing it. And we're going to sit, you know, we're going to let it happen and just wait it out. And so just as the failure to enforce with Clive and Bundy, I would argue, has fostered any number of subsequent, you know, emboldened efforts, I don't know whether it would be unique. I don't know whether their passive response or their refusal to decisively enforce it would be unique to environmentalists or anti-environmentalists and cowboys, or whether they'd do the same thing no matter what the interest is. I mean, we can assess the same, you know, with the Black Lives Matter movement or other affiliate groups and their response in an urban context, but I don't know what the response would be. Maybe this is just, you know, their protocol with respect to an armed occupation in an isolated context, is to bow off and try to let it, you know, lose its steam on its own.
So what, I guess now two questions. We only have like a minute left or 2 minutes left. First question is, so if you could determine the response by the feds, what would it be? And then the next question is, how do you think, the crystal ball is always cloudy, but how do you think that this action will play out? And I'm not so interested in the immediate, but how do you think it'll play out in politics over the next 5 years? And you've sort of answered that already. So first question, what would be your response if you were the feds?
My response would be to wait for an opportunity to decisively enforce the law. I mean, I think with the first Clive and Bundy, it's an outrage that Clive isn't in jail right now and that all of his property isn't seized, given what he owes. In this instance, the same situation. I think that there needs to be a message sent to particularly, public lands ranchers and anybody or miners or anybody that is making these pushes on these anti-environmental fronts, that, you know, the rule of law matters and that it matters in the environmental context. Otherwise, I think you're going to see more and more of this, and I think you're going to see greater and greater degrees of atrophy with respect to the willingness of agencies that are charged with managing public land to enforce environmental protections. And so it'd be a decisive response if I, you know, just like it is in any other law enforcement context.
So is there anything you've wanted to say about this issue that I have not given you the opportunity to? Take like 30 seconds to just say whatever message you want to deliver about this to the public that I've not given you the opportunity.
Well, I just reiterate that public lands ranching is the most destructive environmental impact in North America, and that what we've seen is an unwillingness to even, you know, an unwillingness to acknowledge that fact, an unwillingness to enforce the laws that are supposed to prevent the destruction that does exist. And I hope that this prompts a healthy conversation that focuses on the communities of life that are currently being destroyed and have been for centuries, so that we can, you know, actualize communities of life on public lands that are healthy and that are rich, because that's not happening right now, and it needs to happen.
Well, thank you so much. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Brian Ertz. This is Derek Jensen, Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.